Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy, 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 Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey, you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. I'm your host, Jimmy Crane, and we are sponsored by the good people at Hotel Lincoln. The next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, including the Second City, and it's not only improviser-friendly, it's also pet-friendly as well, check out the Hotel Lincoln. We're also sponsored by Uncle Fun for almost three decades. Uncle Fun has been a Chicago institution. If you're a kid or a grown-up, you will find an enormous selection of fun stuff from around the globe because they're looking all the time for cool stuff like vintage toys, novelty items, unique treasures, and cards. If you want to spend a dollar or $100, you will always leave with a bigger smile than when you walked in. Uncle Fun, it's at 1338 West Belmont in Chicago. Now, if you're a fan of musical improv, you are going to love this episode. Our guest today is Mike Dakota. And I'm not exaggerating when I say he is a musical genius. He is currently the artistic director for Improv Boston. But before that, he was the founder of the musical program at Second City. He was also a musical director there for the ETC cast. But any musical improv group, Baby Wants Candy, Musical the Musical, he was associated with. And the guy did it at a very young age. He didn't even, as you'll hear in this interview, he hadn't even finished Northwestern University here in Chicago before he started to work for Second City. What I think you're going to find very fascinating in this interview is Mike shares with us what is going on in his head when he plays piano for a musical improv show and how he's really improvising along with them. He also shares how to score an improv scene and how that's kind of a lost art. This episode really ends up being a advanced course in musical improv. Now, we did this, we taped this out in Improv Boston. So my wife and I flew into Boston, and that Saturday I was teaching an artist low comedy workshop. My wife was going to visit her sister and her brother-in-law who had just had a new baby, our nephew Owen. So I taught an artist low comedy workshop, and it was just, they were really enthusiastic. They were a great bunch of people. A couple people came from New York. I think someone came from Vermont. It was just, it was really exciting, and they loved what I was teaching. I taught them, you know, to slow stuff down and to work off your partner and to come out in a scene. They love this concept to come out in a scene with nothing and just take all the information off your partner to create together. So that night, I will do Improv Nerd with my guest, Mike Dakota, which you're about to hear. And for the improv portion, Mike has put together the best of the musical improv players in Boston. Now, a lot of these players who I'll be performing with have also taken the workshop. So Mike is just, you can't find a guy who's more enthusiastic, has more passion, and is a harder worker. I mean, this guy has boundless energy, and I have to say, I'm jealous of it. I mean, he really is just like, I don't think this guy ever sleeps. So he's called the cast in together an hour before the show so they can rehearse and get it down, and so it's really tight. I join them like a half hour into the rehearsal before the show just to, you know, so I'm comfortable, and because I'm just going to tell you guys right now, I am terrified of musical improv. I'm scared of musical improv. I don't think I'm very good at musical improv. It just intimidates me. It really does. It's not my thing. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it for the good of Improv Nerd. So we go and we do the show. And we get to the improv portion of it. And we're doing a condensed version of a musical. And now you'll hear this shortly, but we all kind of take turns doing scenes. Well, I come out in like the third scene. And I've planned what I'm going to come out with because I am terrified. And I know that's probably not the best improv, but I was scared, and so I planned it, and I came out and I did it. And then it comes up in the interview. I admit that I planned it, and one of the people in the cast said, "Well, that you didn't, you know, you told us not to do that in your workshop." Now I'm feeling a lot of embarrassment. Then after the show, and I'm going to just say it's a great show. I'm as you know, I'm hard on myself, and I always have to leave a show with some shame, and this show was no exception. So I admit that, and feel a lot of embarrassment when I do that. And then after the show, I'm still feeling bad, and I'm kind of going to the cast to get one of those indirect, like, no, you didn't do really that bad. So I say something like, oh, I you know, that was really rough, or I had really a hard time doing it. And they go, oh my God, that was so easy. We just did what you taught us in class in the workshop this morning. And of course I felt worse, because I felt like I was, as a teacher and as an improviser, a total fraud. You're going to enjoy this episode a lot. Mike Dakota is one of the best people, and he is so generous, and like I said, so enthusiastic about musical improv and improv in general. Please enjoy what we call the Mike Dakota episode.
He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah.
To get to interview you, and it's just great to see you.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you here.
Because when I knew you, you were like 22 years old. You were filled with so much energy, and I was so jealous of your energy, because you, Brian Posehn, Mick Napier, you guys not only had a lot of energy, but you also had a following. People would follow you. You were a leader.
And I moved to Boston to get away from that.
Yeah. Yeah. But, as I was researching, at 6 years old, you played tons of instruments. Can you tell us what instruments you played?
Sure. I didn't play any of them very well, but I picked up piano and drums and recorder and a little bit of clarinet. Starting to play around.
And then, this is what I love. So you go to Northwestern, you were a theater major, but you switched to a music major.
Mm-hmm.
Then, sophomore year, you get exposed to musical improv.
Right. That was my first formal experience in musical improv, and it was a show called Musical the Musical, which was directed by Nancy Howland Walker, which actually some of our IB fans are familiar with, and our actors are, because Nancy was the artistic director of Improv Boston for a number of years.
Now, she put the show up here originally, right?
She was. She did. It was called, it had a different name. Don, do you remember what the name was?
The second act of Improv Boston's main stage show.
Yeah. It's a kind of cumbersome title, but the second act of Improv Boston's main stage show. I don't think it was an official title. But it ultimately became Musical the Musical. And then she brought it to Chicago, she brought it to Nashville.
So really, musical improv started in Boston.
Yeah.
Sure.
Why are you saying, you're kind of smiling and smirking about that? Do you not think that's what happened?
I think musical improv started in a number of different cities with a number of different groups, various origins.
Mm-hmm.
And you could certainly trace musical improv all the way back to Comedia if you wanted to.
And then, is your sophomore year at Northwestern.
Yeah.
You get the musical director for Musical the Musical. Now, you don't know what the hell you're doing. So how do you, and you're doing like 6 shows a week or something, right?
Yeah, we were doing a 3-month run at the Theater Building, which is now Stage 773 mm-hmm. in Chicago, which is a pretty impressive theater.
It's where we do
improv.
Our show, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's Brian Posehn, it's great.
And at that time, it was standard theater ticket prices, not improv ticket prices. So you're talking about $25 ticket to see an improvised musical.
So how did you feel? Did you feel a lot of pressure? Because you didn't know what you were doing, right, at this point?
I didn't. I think if I did know what I was doing, I never would have done the project. We did the impossible, but because that was my first real improv exposure, I didn't realize that what we were doing was impossible. So it was essentially creating a 2-act modern Broadway style musical completely on the spot.
And so how did you prepare for that? How did you come up to speed for that?
That's a good question. I always think it's interesting when people are asking about, how do you rehearse improv?
Right.
It's ultimately not a scripted thing. For me, it meant learning as many different styles of musical theater as humanly possible. Not just styles, but going really in depth to find out the structures. How do musicals work from the first note in the overture to the final bow? How do you actually construct a musical. So it was hours and hours and hours and hours every day, every week, in the practice room, just poring over actual, you know, giant scores from musicals, trying to figure out what makes these things tick. What are the structures that they use? How do melodies work? What is the intersection between character and music? So just needing to understand musical theater on the most fundamental level to ultimately be able to make it up on the spot.
So when you were done with that show, what things did you learn that you could then hand down to other groups like Baby Wants Candy?
Yeah, I mean, I think I learned pretty much everything through that show, at least as far as the inner workings of musical theater goes. I mean, I actually think I got more of a musical theater education from musical to musical than I did from the music theater certificate program at Northwestern. But I think through that discovery process, the research process, working with a cast, many of whom would go on to do just ridiculous things, just discovering with this ensemble, oh, okay, here's how musical improv ticks. And for me, it was also discovering, here's how traditional improvisation ticks. Because I dabbled in it, but I'd never actually, at that point, gone through any conservatories or studied it outside of traditional acting programs.
Was there one technique that you learned in that process?
Oh, there's so many techniques. I think the one that really stood out, that we were just practicing down in the green room a few minutes ago, the idea of earning a song was probably the most pivotal concept.
So explain that to people that are listening, and to me, who don't understand that.
Sure. Well, I think actually every improviser fundamentally understands the idea of heightening a scene. And essentially, in music, you have, for a successful song, you basically have to heighten the emotions to the point where the character can no longer express what she's feeling through words. She's got to sing it. So it gets you to that point of life and death stakes where a song wouldn't be fun, a song has to be. And so that's really the fundamental technique. And in the process, everyone's scene work gets better.
Now, you explain that technique, and the problem I think people have with musical improv is they go into plot a lot. Mm-hmm. So how do you avoid that?
That's a good question. Depending on the structure of the musical improv, sometimes you can't avoid it. In the case of musical to musical, where they're doing a long, essentially a literal narrative based on an audience suggestion, you can't avoid it. And so I think that was the biggest struggle for the actors was, how do we get two acts of emotional content without being stuck in our heads? And I think it's no different than the struggle a lot of improvisers playing with super structured long form formats tend to experience. Maybe, you know, you're exploring the Herald for the first time, you're really up in your head about, how do all these, you know, sets of scenes connect? How do I do that and still keep up my solid scene work? So if you're tackling narrative in musical improv, the secret for me is looking backwards. You're improvising the entire musical by looking in the rear view mirror. What have we already established? And let's play with what we've already established instead of looking forward to trying to predict where the story's gonna go. Because it's improv and you never know.
So let me throw some other things
sure.
that people will say. They'll say about musical improv. First of all, I'm terrified of it. Why do you think people are terrified of it? And I've been improvising for a long time.
Yeah, I think they're terrified of it for the same reason that a batch of level one or level A students in improv are terrified the first day they show up. It's a brand new skill. It's something they don't know if they're going to be good at. It's taking a risk, and anything that involves taking a risk is going to be scary. For me, probably the single greatest joy of working in musical improv is the realization that improvisers have once they start working with it of, oh, I actually already know how to do all of this. It's a heightening of all of the skills that are required for traditional good improvisation. And I think that was the biggest shocker to me working in the music program at Second City, as we were discovering what are the elements, how do we build a conservatory out of musical improv? Because at that time it was really seen as the bastard stepchild of improv. Like, you have to be the absolute best improviser to be able to handle this crazy musical improv thing, because it's totally different.
Or The other thing is you have to have a really good singing voice. So mm-hmm. what do you tell people who say, oh, I don't sing?
It's not you singing, it's the character. And that sounds nutty, crunchy, kumbaya, but...
Totally. You know, when you're crunchy, kumbaya.
It absolutely
extra
is.
Nutty, crunchy, kumbaya.
It yes. is, right? Except if you're terrified. And then as you do exercises that allow you to feel what it feels like to be putting on a character and have that character's voice be what's heard as opposed to, oh, it's not about me. It's not about having a pretty voice. I think some of the best musical improvisers I've ever worked with can carry a tune, but aren't what anyone would call brilliant singers. And in fact, some of the best singers I know are some of the most challenged musical improvisers because they're so in their head about technique.
Rhyming. I'm not a good rhymer. I can't do it. What do you say to that? I'm really coming at you with these are hard-hitting questions.
I just get grilled. I thought this was a fluff piece.
No, it's not. Did you listen to the podcast?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I did. I think rhyming for me is icing on the cake. It's real tough to eat on its own. You got to have the cake first. For a lot of new musical improvisers, the first concern is rhyming. If I can rhyme, I've got this musical improv thing nailed. That's not the case. You have to have the emotions. If you have the character, you have the emotions, you have the physicality, you're expressing what the character feels, you are a musical improv rock star. If you can rhyme on top of that, all the better. But some of the best musical improv you'll see isn't rhyme heavy. You know, certainly there's a bunch of great freestyle hip-hop improv shows out there that are absolutely reliant on rhymes. There are techniques. I think of it as scales on piano. If you run those scales and you run them day and night, eventually it's in your fingers and you don't think about it. Same thing with rhyming. There's some techniques where you're practicing the skill set of rhyming when you wake up, you practice it when you go to bed, you practice it with your musical improv troupe, and eventually 6 months later, you look back and you realize, I'm not in my head about the rhymes anymore. It's just a skill set that's been internalized.
When you go and you see a show,
yeah.
a musical improv show, you're directing or you're watching, what are the elements that have to be working for you?
The improv. If it's not good improv, it's not good musical improv. And that to me, you were talking about it a second ago with that sort of revelation of, oh, musical improv is just heightened traditional improvisation. So typically, if a musical improv show or even just a musical improv game within a regular improv show isn't working, it's not the music part, it's the improv part. So first you have to analyze, do we have a strong relationship? Do we have people that care about each other? Do we have people that are agreeing in their scene? And is there enough of emotional foundation to be able to build and get to that song? If not, you shouldn't be singing. Probably you shouldn't be improvising. You should start that scene over.
What can musical improv do that regular improv can't?
I think two elements. One is a process, one is a product. For the process element, it allows you, and I think it's the only, maybe calling an acting method is too pretentious, but for the
sake of it. Go ahead.
Well, let's do it. Let's get pretentious.
I like pretentious.
Great.
Yeah.
So to get super pretentious,
great.
I think it's the only acting method that allows you to work inside out and outside in at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're a traditional actor, you're working with a script, you do your table work, you spend, you know, 3 days coming up with your character's backstory, what they want, who they are. That's working internally, and eventually it works its way out to your physicality. So you're going from emotions out. Or some improvisers like to work outside in, starting with the physicality, make a strong physical gesture, your character comes from that, your emotion comes from that strong physical gesture, right? That would be outside in. I think different improvisers are strongest working different ways. Musical improv, because of the magic of what music can do, allows you to access both the internal and the external at the exact same time, and to work both of them without having to think about it.
So I'm gonna play devil's advocate.
Great.
You love musical theater. You loved it since you were a kid. That's mm-hmm. easy for you to say because you love musical theater.
Sure.
You also come from a music background. Mm-hmm. I'm 24 years old. I've been doing improv. I'm really funny on stage. I look at musical improv like short form. I'm beyond it. I don't need that. It's gimmicky. What do you tell that person?
Take a workshop with me. Honestly, it's...
You've heard this before,
of course,
right?
Of course, okay. Of course. I mean, that's where... That's when we started the music program at Second City. That was the premise that I started from. It's this gimmicky, again, sort of bastardized version of improv that really bears no resemblance to what we consider good improvisation.
Right, and I remember when it started, with you're like... For me, I was like, this isn't gonna last.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think that was a common attitude, don't you think?
I do. I think that. And I think that stigma still exists. The discovery that we made in Chicago, you know, about a decade ago, working as we started to get our hands really dirty with this, the theory behind musical improv, beyond the, oh, here's Baby Wants Candy, they're just magically great at this stuff and no one understands how. And here's musical, who are crazy structure Nazis and like no one wants to get in their head that bad. For everyone else, you know, those are the two extremes. As we started to create a bridge between those extremes and to explore what is actually the theory that creates good musical improv, the light bulb that went off was, oh no, it's not different. It requires every ounce of what you know how to do as a good improviser already. It just requires more of it. So for me, when I'm getting people into a musical improv workshop, I actually don't care about the product, it's the process. Give me 6 improvisers who are at the top of their game and we will put them through their paces, and musical improv can be an amazing diagnostic to expose challenges that they didn't know that they had. If you hit a tableau as a brilliant improviser, you go to musical improv and it will immediately show you where those areas are that you can improve.
But give me an example.
Sure. If you, for instance, think you are phenomenal at yes-anding, mm-hmm. but in fact, you're just bringing in the same agenda to every scene. Let's say you start a scene, and every time you start a scene, it's with the same basic perspective, but you're really clever, so nothing your director is doing is actually pulling you out of that mindset.
And worse, you're probably getting laughs.
Oh, of course.
So
it's reinforcing. There's no reason to change, right?
So, yeah.
So you say to yourself, I'm saying yes to my scene partners, but you're not actually allowing what they're saying to affect you and to change you. If we're on the piano, you know, you're doing, you start that same initiation that you...
We're actually going to move over to the piano. Mike, just for the people, Mike jumped, he walked about 10 feet over to the piano. Okay.
So, you know, if you're doing the same type of emotional character initiation you always do, but the piano this time comes
which
in
which for
with,
me is angry. I always start angry.
Great. Okay. So, Jimmy, start something angry.
Okay. Oh, Mike, I can't believe you. You left the butter out again.
Right? And so this underscoring is absolutely playing into what you already do really well, right?
Right.
Same initiation. You're the same initiation.
Okay. Mike, I can't believe you left the butter out.
Right. And because Jimmy's a phenomenal improviser, you immediately reacted and responded accordingly with the music, right? But there are a lot of fantastic improvisers who wouldn't, right? They would keep going with the angry thing all the while the music...
Mike, you left the butter out. I'm ignoring your suggestion.
And if you're ignoring the initiation... If you're ignoring the initiation of the music director, how many other initiations are you ignoring, right? So it can be a technique to say... To just basically give you a different entryway into how you think about scene work. It can really open you up.
Now, you're by the piano, and we're lit here, so it's fine. Are you more comfortable here than on stage? Because you look it.
Sure, great, yeah. This is. I can hide behind this. This is nice.
It brings up something else that I want to talk about in terms of... you said at Second City that you didn't create a curriculum, you were developing a form.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. I think that was one of the most exciting things about being at Second City at that time. They basically handed me carte blanche. I'd just only been on the touring company for a couple of months when they said, here, come in and take this.
Yeah, well, you hadn't even graduated from college.
No.
Yeah.
My first day as head of the music program was my graduation from college. Yeah.
How'd you ever finish college, by the way?
They basically wanted to get rid of me.
Okay.
As I was very demanding. So, essentially, we started playing around with I mean, I was doing Baby Wants Candy, and I was doing Musical the Musical, and then they handed me this, again, this carte blanche to create a music program without really knowing what exactly that entailed. So we just started playing. We started doing workshops. You know, the music program started as basically a three-hour workshop once a term, and then we got students who were excited, and we started experimenting with different approaches, different techniques, different forms, and then that led to a two-week workshop, and that led to a three-week workshop, and that led to an eight-week workshop. It led to the creation of ensembles, the most notable probably Jazz Hands Across America, which had people like Brian Gallivan in it, and Christina Anthony, and Jeff Boothiette, who's running the music program now, all these amazing folks. And through that experimentation, and through the teaching of the classes, we were actually pioneering the theory of the genre as we were going, which was... I don't think you do that a lot in classes. I think you expect when you show up to a class that the teacher has some idea of what they're talking about. But in these classes, it was, all right, we have a starting point. Let's see what we can discover together. And it wasn't much later till I really felt like, okay, I understand this whole Spolin stuff, that I realized, oh, wait, that's what she was doing the whole time.
Right? So when you were coming into my classes, when I was at Second City, you didn't know what you were doing?
Well, I was taking classes. I was basically like going through a level A, pulling what Brian Posen told me, and then pulling into the
and then
workshop
you'd pull in your piano. You had like a Casio tone on like rollers or something.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, okay, let's do a music workshop. And so enthusiastic and so passionate. And I've always, where did you get that, by the way? The enthusiasm and passion. Now, you're a little more calmed down. I think age is, you know, but you were so, like, you could get by in, like, 2 hours of sleep in those days.
Yeah, it was pretty much 24/7, but that's, I mean, if you're in theater and you're not passionate, you're in the wrong business, you know?
I may be in the wrong business.
You're not in the wrong business, Jimmy.
Thank you. So we're going to improvise now.
Great.
Okay. So we've got a great cast that you've assembled here in Boston. Mm-hmm. So do you want to tell us a little about them before we bring them up?
Absolutely. And this actually isn't a pre-existing cast. These are some of the best improvisers at the theater that I just asked to do the show when you emailed me. And so these are folks that represent just different strengths at the theater. We have folks who are great at long form, folks who are great at musical improv, folks who do our main stage show, which is a combination of long form and some short form games as well. So I just wanted to pull together a diverse bunch of talents and sort of show that, you know, if you love improv and you're good at improv, musical improv is not actually very far of a leap.
Great. So, and we rehearsed a little before, just so people know. Mm-hmm. I'm terrified.
We scripted out all the lyrics. All the melodies are set.
Yeah, great.
All the structures are done in advance.
Great. Excellent. Okay, so let's bring them up, and then we'll get a suggestion from the audience. And
perfect.
Then we'll, okay, great. So what we need is a suggestion. We set a location, right?
Sure.
Okay. So we're going to need a location that could fit on the stage.
Please.
Yoga studio.
Now here's something interesting. I heard what did you say, sir?
This stage.
This stage, and then someone said a yoga studio. Mm-hmm. Now, how would you grab that suggestion? You hear the stage and yoga studio. What would you do in this situation?
Typically, I would combine them. A yoga studio on a stage.
Okay. Or a yoga studio. Or a yoga studio that has a stage.
Sure.
Great. That's really good. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to bring a yoga studio that has a stage.
And before we get going, just to introduce everyone so you know who's playing. This is Ben.
Hi.
Hi.
Mark.
Hello.
Ken.
Hey.
And Don.
Hello.
And Jimmy, you're going to play with us, right?
Yeah, I'm going to play, sure.
Great.
So yoga studio that has a stage.
Perfect. Great.
Relax, breathe in, feel your inner peace, and realize that
cause you're on stage. From the female customers about your yoga pants.
I can't get into my space unless I'm comfortable.
But they are very, very tight, Bobby. They're very tight, and your choice of not wearing undergarments leaves little to the imagination.
Yeah, that's right, I just gotta be me.
Not as flexible as I used to be, Sandra. I can't stand the pressure of not being as good as everybody else.
Don't you quit on yoga and don't you quit on me, Steven.
I'm not quitting on yoga. Yoga's quitting on me.
Thank you.
Completely sober now.
You want me to give you your AA chip? This isn't an AA meeting, this is a yoga class. Okay, Kyle?
Listen, Derek. I'm here to support you. This is your class.
I'm here to support you with my naked body.
I said Carl, but your name is Kyle. Because I'm seeing Carl. Kyle, you ruined it. You had a chance with me, and that was 2 months ago. But you seem to enjoy alcohol more than you did me. I never thought you'd get sober, but apparently you have.
Marches forward, always marching, and we move from the marching penguin into, of course, the buttress of pigs, which I believe you were going
teacher,
to
demonstrate. Can we do the buttress of pigs together? And perhaps we can step through the yogi statement that informs us of the buttress of pigs. We should do the meditation that we state during the buttress of pigs together, teacher.
Well, as my most advanced student, you certainly know the meditation chant that goes along with the buttress of pigs.
Yes, and the one that you taught me, and we have sung together so many times.
Yes.
Ah.
less afraid.
Do you think the studio would do that service?
Relax! You're on stage!
There's no stage!
Yeah!
Relax!
Are you doing it?
Yoga.
Let's talk about that.
Okay.
Shall we? Relax. You're on stage. Okay. So let's talk about the opening number.
Great.
Okay. What techniques were used in that?
Well, first, just setting a theme for the whole show, just like you would in a lot of different long-form structures. You know, you have a section where you throw ideas out that may or may not come back throughout the rest of the show. So in this case, the suggestion of yoga is a great input, a lot of rich stuff that we can get from that. And then the stage idea, real meta, which is always fun for improvisers.
What do you mean meta?
Meta-theatrical, there's a level of self-recognition of the work we're doing, so being able to break the fourth wall and say, there's an audience in this yoga studio, because there's actually an audience in this theater right now. So that kind of working on multiple levels is fun to do.
How did we get to the chorus?
Well, we built up emotion enough, and someone, was it Don? I think Don felt at some point that emotion had boiled up with enough intensity to earn that chorus of relax. I think for me as a music director, taking that suggestion, looking at the physicality on stage, knowing, well, it's an opening number, so it's got to have a certain amount of energy. We can't do a...
No.
Like, that's not like going to really
yeah,
do
that's,
it?
Yeah, that's like second act, yeah, sure.
So how... the entire second act.
Right, yeah.
It's just the audience. We actually have a fully improvised yoga show happening next month. I'm not even joking.
You're not kidding?
No, it's called Vinya Hahasa.
Great. I think you brought that from Chicago, didn't you?
I know, wish I did.
Yeah, I think it was at the conservatory back in 2007.
No, that's entirely...
So it's got to be an upbeat song, is what you're saying.
You know, it's got to have some sort of intensity to it.
Now, you said something that was interesting about... Because we've not done a show with the musical director. And right. You said you need to be two steps ahead of... the players on stage, the improvisers. What do you mean by that?
I think part of the music director's job to really earn the title of music director, as opposed to, hey, piano guy.
Who gets $40.
Who gets, yeah, if you're lucky.
Right.
So I think part of the idea of the music director is to have a real strong understanding of the basic tenets of improvisation. To be able to look at a scene, know exactly what's going on, and knowing with these particular players that ideally, like these guys you've worked with for a while, knowing what moves they are very likely to make next, so that you can either support them or help guide them in a direction.
So what were you anticipating in this first number with people that you've worked with before?
I knew it was going to be highly physical.
Okay, why was that?
Because these guys are highly physical.
Okay.
And we had an entire stage to fill, and mm-hmm. it's an opening number, so we all agree on the convention that we want this to be energized both physically and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, okay, what can we do to give them that energy, but also have some of those tones in there that make it sound a little new agey? Maybe there's some flavor of yoga in there. But give them enough of that groove that they can find... maybe identify that emotion, focus it, heighten it to the point where they feel supported enough to sing, as opposed to if I'm just doing, and then Don's got to try to figure out, how do I make an opening number out of that? Similar to, you know, McNapier's school of thought, you got to take care of yourself before you can take care of anyone else on the stage, right? So if I'm just playing schmaltz, they have nothing to go on. Whereas if I could have made a totally different choice, I could have done... played with that entirely differently, because it's got a totally different emotional context.
But you're saying the musical director has to play it strong.
Yeah.
So it can't be subtle because they have to be able to pick it up.
Right. It's like an improviser walking on stage with a half-baked initiation or...
being tentative.
If you're being tentative, right? Yeah. Tentative. And when I was working at Second City, and there was one point where I was recruiting and training something like 30 music directors a year for Second City, and the biggest challenge that these new music directors would face was that they were just kind of noodling, too tentative. So they weren't actually, even though it was done out of deference to the actors, saying, I want these actors to take the lead, they're the experts, by playing tentatively, they were sucking the energy out of the scene and making it really difficult for the improvisers to have any kind of foundation to build on.
But we're going to get off a tangent. We're going to get back onto this because I want to just talk about, I think they were probably struggling in the Second City structures because they also score the shows. Mm-hmm. So tell us the difference between scoring an improv show and being a musical director for a musical improv group.
Great. I don't think there is a difference. I think all things are... fall under that broadest title of music director. So you are, and music director in a comedy context is very different from music director in traditional musical theater, where you are the person in musical theater, you're the guy that reads the dots on the page and teaches that to the cast and, you know, basically is responsible for the sound, but you are not creating the music. In comedy, your music director is often creating the music in an improv setting, composing the music, like in a Second City traditional review. They are creating the sound design for the show, and sometimes in a scripted review, that sound design is scripted ahead of time, so you're using all kinds of programs and bells and whistles to create either sound effects or drop tracks. Or in an improv setting, you are improvising the sound design on the fly.
So when I was starting out, this is back in the late 80s, you would do, we would do the Herald, this was at I.O., mm-hmm. and you'd always have a piano player.
Right, and they still do.
Right. Now, the longer I've been around, the less a piano player is people are kind of like, oh, we can do forms without a piano player. Are we losing something without a piano player?
Well, I'm a little biased, but absolutely.
And what are we losing by that?
Okay, so here's the list. You are losing, and I've had to make this pitch to producers literally the world over. First, you're losing polish. In a traditional improv stage where you have two chairs and a blank stage and no costumes, we're lucky at IB to have a lot of different lights to play with, but a lot of theaters, as you know, lights up, lights down, that's all you've got. So the music is actually providing the sets. The music is providing the costumes. The music is providing the transitions. The music is providing the punctuation and the clarity that allows the audience to understand the structure of the show. The music is providing the energy underneath the show that a lot of times the audience wouldn't be able to tell you why, but it's the difference between a show that they loved and leave going, that was amazing, and a show that they go, oh, that was great, that was fine. It's imagine Indiana Jones without the score. Imagine Schindler's List without the score. I don't know why I'm only picking John Williams scores. Probably because they're the thickest, they're the most dense scores, right? Imagine any good movie and remove the music from it. Try watching it again. It's a very different experience.
Why are we losing them? Why are we losing the piano accompaniment in improv?
I think it depends on the theater. Here at Improv Boston, we're actually adding shows that are...
Well, but that would make sense because that's where you started. That's your love. But why are we losing it today?
I think...
Is it a cost thing?
It's a cost thing. It's a supply demand. There are vastly fewer music directors than there are improvisers. I think, at least in Chicago, it is almost every group's desire to have a music director, even if they're not, you know, doing musical improv. People know what a music director can offer as far as
because
style.
Here's the thing: right. When you were in Chicago, you probably could have played. You could have worked every night.
Right.
You know, with different groups, you could have been at I.O., right. You could have been at The Annoyance, getting paid, you know, the piano player always got paid, right?
Yeah. Not always. Not always.
Really?
And certainly when a music director, similar to an improviser, although the track is much shorter, when a music director starts out, you start out by doing free work. I didn't because there were so few music directors at that time, but once I had started the Second City program where we were recruiting and training them, we started churning out music directors every year, and the typical progression was they'd spend about a year playing shows for free, learning their craft.
Okay, this is interesting because as long as I've been in Chicago, as long as I've improvised, I didn't know that people were actually training musical directors.
Similar to musical improv, it wasn't a thing that existed before the work we did. There was no school for it, there was no major for it. There was no book for it. Ultimately, after we started the program, Michael Pollack, who was the music director for Second City out in L.A., was a great friend and a brilliant guy. He actually created what is still the only book in music direction. And we were running in Chicago what is the only program to actually train music directors. And as soon as we would graduate them, they would get sent off to a cruise ship with Second City or go to another city and get paid to work at another theater.
Okay, so let's talk about the second scene in our musical that we just did. Tell me a little about that. Do you remember it?
Remind me. Second scene is...
you guys who were in it?
And Don and myself. Yeah.
Tight pants.
Tight pants.
Right.
What did you see in it?
What did I see in it? In terms of musical?
In terms of how did it... how did you see the music and the scene relating? Am I allowed to ask you questions?
You can. I just don't have the answer.
I mean, we had been talking a little bit in the interview about the idea of what is the relationship between scene and song.
Right.
And for me, I thought Ben and Don did a great job building that relationship to a point where it felt like another means of expression was needed.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, I noticed in this this musical that we did, we got right to it.
Right.
There was no we weren't doing any slow comedy. We're getting right to the meat of the scene. Is that a technique that was used in
it's
that?
It's absolutely
first?
A technique, okay. And we used it here because we had a very limited amount of time,
mm-hmm.
right? So we wanted to get to the song quick, and we were blessed to have your workshop this morning where we were able to take a lot of time to get to the really deep stuff and the fun stuff. And I think when we're earning a song, any song worth its salt can be earned in 4 to 5 lines within a scene, but the trick to it is to condense all of the work that you would do in a 3-minute scene.
So what is that work that you got to do to get there?
Every line counts for more.
Okay, so you're giving specifics, you're giving information, you're endowing your character, and you're giving emotion.
It's react, 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 react.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you need, you had when you walked into the scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of looking at your scene partner and truly taking in what they're saying so that it can transform you on a fundamental level.
Okay, now that sounds Goombaya again.
Okay.
Okay.
It does.
Okay, so how do you break it down simply?
Person A says something they care about. Person B...
Give me an example.
Okay. I have been in love with you for 17 years.
Okay.
Person B makes that the most important thing their character has ever heard.
So they either love it, right? That would be one emotional choice. They could be pissed off about that, you know?
You really only have 4 emotional choices. You love it, you hate it, you fear it, or you want to fuck it.
Right.
So
I didn't know fuck was an emotion.
Okay. Good luck on the baby thing. So you basically have 4 primal reactions.
Okay.
And any one of those is going to work, and any one of those is going to earn you a song.
Do you think that's true in regular improv? We only have 4 primary emotions to react to?
It's like primary colors. I think so. You can blend them and create an infinite number of subtler emotions. Mm-hmm. I just said subtler. That's weird.
And we don't edit out, so it's...
Oh, good.
Yeah.
It's in there.
Yeah.
Well, staying on the pretentious train.
Right.
I think, you can create any number of reactions and emotions, but if you're wondering where do I start, those 4 will get you there.
Okay. Then we had the third scene, or the second scene, which was, it was Mark and Dina, and it was a duet, kind of a love.
What was the hook of that?
I wanted to quit.
Don't quit on yoga,
don't quit on yoga. I feel like most improvisers have this experience where when they're super in the moment, they can't remember anything they did, right after the show. The same thing for music directors. Your brain is so involved.
Why is that? Because you're in the moment?
You're so in the moment, supporting them. Your fingers are doing, 10 different things. you're trying to stay two steps ahead of them while you're trying to hear every word that they're saying, figure out what the emotion is, how do you support it. You're it's a locomotive where you are literally putting the track down in front of you as the train is going along.
And you're also putting the wood into the steam thing so the steam comes out.
So if you're doing all of that correctly, you're using so much of your mental capacity that you don't have a lot left over for remembering what happened. So it was a love duet, I remember that.
Yeah.
And what's the question?
Well, what do we think of it?
As far as techniques involved?
Yeah. What techniques did we see in there?
Well, obviously I think you saw two improvisers in extreme agreement on what the context of their relationship was, what the dynamic was, enough to be able to crystallize it in a song to be able to explore. I think you saw them doing good work pushing plot away so that they could really stay with exploring the relationship, which is very hard in musical improv, and honestly very hard in improv as well. It's harder to hide in musical improv. If you're getting up into your head and you're getting super situational, it comes out very quickly. So I think they did a good job deepening the relationship as opposed to driving to gimmicky lyrics and sort of forcing the rhyme, which happens
Where were they delving deeper into the relationship?
Good question. Do you guys remember?
Mark's pain. Mark was in pain. I was in a lot of pain.
He was in a lot of pain. Oh, yeah. There's the counterpoint. Yeah, there was that really cool counterpoint at the end where Dino was doing a rock out money note.
Right.
And Mark was sort of riffing off on that, really just continuing to commit and commit and commit to the character as opposed to bailing on the emotion for the sake of a lyric, which is what you see a lot of in earlier phases of musical improv.
Right. Okay, then it was my scene with
Ken.
Okay. How'd we do there?
You did awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
First of all, I came out, and for whatever reason, I was thinking Martin DeMott.
Oh, cool.
Like I was going to be an improv guru. And then Ken, which was a great move, made it about us, you know, a relationship about us, which all of those scenes, they made it about the relationship, which I thought was great. Yes, but I felt a little tentative in there.
It started tentative, but it didn't end up tentative.
Okay.
What do you remember from it?
I remember, like, I had an idea, like, I was going to be a guru, and this is what I was singing on the back line. So I saw those guys had done the duet before, and I was like, fuck, I wanted to do a duet. Yeah. I wanted to do something like the schmaltzy, you know? Because I love the good schmaltz, like anybody else. And then, so I'm like, I can't do that, because just like any other long form, we don't want to have the same thing back to back. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be a guru, and I'm going to sing a song about how great I am as a guru. Then I came out, and that was, you know, that was changed. Right. So I had to drop my idea, and then I thought it worked out. I was scared. I was tentative. Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you find once the music came in and the song got going? Were you just as scared at the end as you were in the beginning?
No, at the end I was less like, okay, this is good. I could, you know, I could keep doing this. You know.
Yeah, and you could, and you will. I think the when you get that kind of that nervousness of suddenly it's about me and singing and coming up with rhymes and these things that get me into my head and pull me out of my scene work, the go-to is listen to the music. You had this really sort of iconic tango. We all have these cultural references built into music. So similar to someone starting a scene with a strong archetype, and you know exactly how to play off that, the musical initiation here has that same kind of understanding, a psychological underpinning where you go, I may not know what the lyrics are, but I have a sense of what this music is doing to my body. I have a sense of what this makes me feel, right? And so I feel maybe a little mysterious, and my body maybe wants to make these tango-ish kind of moves. Start there. Let that music, momentum goes out of my talking when I, so you have that, you know, so it gives you that energy, right? And that drive, and if you trust that physicality, and you trust that emotion that the music is suggesting, the lyrics don't matter. You know, you could stand there and sing, na da 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 da, and use that, just like you would use a gibberish exercise in the beginning improv, use that to ground you.
I wish I would have made that choice.
You want to do it again?
No, I'm fine. Okay, then we had Then it was the fourth scene. We edit the was it like chanting kind of thing?
Yeah, that sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is pretty.
Which actually, Don called for.
Yeah.
And I want to give a shout out to Don for calling for it in a really non-assholey way.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get improvisers who want to pimp another improviser's
right.
song. Hey, piano man, hit it! It's like pet peeve number one. But the way Don called for the song was organic to the scene, and I felt like he could have started that a cappella, mm-hmm. and it would have been fine, whereas sometimes really bulldozery improvisers will just start singing, and then the music director scrambling to like find the style and find the key. And
so for improvisers, they've got to be listening to you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because we are listening to them.
Because I think the people that are starting out don't think that
right.
way.
It's listening, it's saying yes, and. It's super basic improv. It's just a slightly different way to listen. Mm-hmm. So instead of listening for the premise or an exposition-heavy initiation from the scene partner, you're listening for... What is that emotion doing?
It may getting close to the end of Improv Nerd with Mike Dakota.
Jimmy, your voice is beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But even if you weren't going to sing on it, right? If this was just underscoring in the scene.
Gentle, you'd be gentle.
That sets a tone,
yeah.
right? That sets an environment or a feeling or a style that you can play off mm-hmm. of.
And then, of course, the last scene, that was easy because it was just a reprise of the opening.
It's just a callback.
Mm-hmm.
So every single one of these concepts we've talked about are basic building blocks of improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little that's substantively different about musical improv than what any basic improviser already knows how to do.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a couple questions and we got to go. And usually okay. we have questions from the audience, but we don't have time tonight.
I'm sorry. Sorry, guys.
No, it was me. Did you guys want to ask a couple quick questions? Yeah. Can we turn the lights up? Well, a couple quick ones. Yeah.
Good morning, guys.
Great. Who's got a question? Just make something up so I don't look like a jerk. Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. Why wouldn't you go to Broadway instead of
me personally or one?
You. I think
oh,
she
me
meant
personally.
You. That's my wife, by the way.
I know. She's
yeah.
beautiful.
Thank you.
Broadway sounds very lofty, but that was originally the track I was on. It was a traditional musical theater writer. I still write a lot of musical theater. I was music directing traditional musicals in Chicago, playing auditions for The Good Men, stuff like that. And I was working for... at the same time that I just started with Second City, I was an assistant on a show called The Last 5 Years for Jason Robert Brown, who's a Tony Award-winning composer. Any musical theater nerds will absolutely know Last 5 Years. So that was absolutely...
It's a great show.
Yeah. Sorry?
It's a great show.
There we go. See? I would play some of it, but I don't want to get sued. So the... So that was absolutely a track that I was on, and I think without being on that track, I would not have been able to do the musical improv.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to follow up question
yeah.
from my wife. Is improv distracting you from doing that?
No, improv is informing what I do.
Is it something in 5 years that, you know what, I've done this thing, I built what I can do here in Boston, just like I did in Chicago, and now I'm going to do songwriting and...
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you do both at the same time. And for me, the next chapter in musical improv and musical theater is the marriage of the two. We'd started playing with this with Jazz Hands Across America, where we, it's hard to say that with a straight face, where we were actually improvising musicals that we would then script, and we brought one actually to New York that we had scripted that was a satire of the Gulf War, back when that was a thing.
You can just change
it's about
war.
To be a thing again.
Yeah, yeah, just use
fine.
Syrian,
so,
yeah.
You know,
Syria,
good
yeah.
for that musical.
Right.
But essentially, pioneering a process where, like Second City does, improv to scripted, we're actually doing musical improv to musical scripted. So for my money, that's the really exciting next big thing, is how do we create quote-unquote legitimate musical theater that doesn't have a 5-year workshop process before it gets a real production, where we can take a headline, take something that people care about, and a month later, 2 months later, churn out a musical that is worth paying for.
Well, if anyone can do it, you can do it, because you have such a good work ethic, and you don't sleep, so...
It's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and we were doing that in Chicago. We did that with a couple of annoyance shows. It's a process. There's a process that's now actually becoming. All
right. So
standard.
Why things were going great in Chicago? Why move back here?
I love Boston. I grew up in Boston. I felt like Chicago's an incredible town. I miss it. I miss all the people. The scene is unbelievable.
And you, I mean, you were rising there. I mean, you were the musical director at ETC.
I just decided I needed to slum it in Boston for a while. I felt like, and this is going to sound really dickish, but I felt like I had done most of what I, not what I could do in Chicago, but what I set out to do, what I wanted to do. And so for me, it was a shit or get off the pot moment of, if I don't take this opportunity to go try something else, I will be in Chicago for the rest of my life, which is not a bad thing at all, because it's an incredible city. But if I'm going to ever do something else, I should probably do it now.
Okay, so what do you want to achieve coming to Improv Boston? What's your goal for Improv Boston?
Well, I think Improv Boston has, you know, exclusive reputation amongst theaters nationwide as being a 30-year-old theater. Comedy theater. That's huge. Very few people that, or organizations that can claim that. So it's basically building on a rich history that already exists. It's, you know, maybe we prop up the musical improv scene, we can grow that a little bit, but it's essentially channeling what is an incredible existing comedy community.
Okay, let's cut to five years. What do you want?
5 years, we have 24 comedians who are making their living here at Improv Boston in comedy. Boston is no longer a city that trains people to ship them out, but a destination for people to come in and make
a circle. Okay, how realistic is this? Because you're not far from New York. I've been here, let's say I've been in Boston for a couple of years. I'm like, you know what? I want to go to the big leagues. I want to go to UCB. I want to go to New York because there's opportunities there. Sure. How do you compete with that in Boston?
We don't have as much competition. There's two major comedy theaters in town, and we have a world-class city. So we've got corporate work for enough to feed entire community of improvisers once we've found its potential. We do work in schools. We have a national touring company.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Right.
That's great. And it's going on in Chicago. It's going on in other cities.
Right.
But will Lorne Michaels come to this theater? Is that one of your goals? Lorne Michaels to come and scout talent. People go on to do different TV and film projects from here.
Yeah, we certainly have a number of top performers who are, quote-unquote, graduating from Improv Boston, heading out to Chicago, heading out to New York, and we certainly support them, encourage them to do that, and give them as many resources as we can, making connections in Chicago and New York. But for me, the ultimate goal would be to have improvisers train here, perform here, and say, I don't want to go to New York. Or, I want to go to New York, go through UCB, and then I want to come back because I can make a living in comedy here, and New England kicks ass.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's a good way to end, but I'm going to ask you to do something.
Okay.
So I want you to think about a song I'd like to end with.
Okay.
And it's interesting because, is this a hard thing for you to be in the spotlight?
Yeah, it's terrifying. I hate it.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Do you think you hide behind the piano?
I support behind the piano.
No, you smile and you're blushing about that, but do you hide behind it?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I was a theater major. I was on stage growing up all the time. So I think 12-year-old version of me is shocked that I'd be as fulfilled behind the piano and directing and arts management as I am, but for me, the joy in taking what some brilliant improvisers are doing on stage and making it a little bit stronger or giving them a different way into a scene, that I like that. I like being sort of out of the lights and behind the scenes, but still contributing. I think there's equal joy in that to being on stage.
Mike Dakota, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Boston. Thank you, Boston. Thanks so much for having us. Check out Improv Nerd on feralaudio.com. There's some other great podcasts there. Chelsea Peretti's got one. Todd Barry, Matt Dwyer. Remember Matt from Chicago?
I sure do.
Yeah, Matt Dwyer's got one. So check that out. Brainwarp the Baby Eater is people from Annoyance, too. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Crane, the Artist Low Comedy, my award-winning classes, my improv blog. I love it. I love writing this improv blog. Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
Yes.
You're a gifted writer, sir.
Thank you very much. And my wife helps me out on it. I couldn't do it without Lauren Corain there. I really appreciate it. So check that out. And that's at jimmycorain.com. You're going to do a song.
Okay.
I was going to say, until next time, walk, don't run. But what I'd like Mike to do a song. He'll play a song, and then we'll bring the lights down. All right?
Okay.
So you want to just set this up for
us? I'll set this up. So thinking about some of what we talked about, and I think that next stage of musical theater coming from musical improv, this is a show that we put up at The Annoyance called Sodomites. And it was a collaboration between me, James Asmus, and Sean Cusick.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure
still
many
there.
Of our listeners will know who's still there. And this was a musical that was written in 6 weeks, using a lot of improvisation in the collaboration process. And then when the cast got the score, continued to improvise on top of it.
So. When you mean improvise, the lyrics, or do you mean the music?
Yeah, some of the music, ad-libbing with the music, some of the lyrics changed. Certainly the scenes that were beated out became more fully fleshed out through what the improvisers and the actors were doing. So to me, while this may not be the funniest song I've ever written, to me it's a good example of that collaborative process and churning out scripted material very quickly.
So that's the process. Do we need any setup for what this is about?
Oh boy. So this is a show built on the story of Lot, which if you want the most horrific read you've ever had the privilege to read, look up. It's in Genesis.
It's a Bible story?
It's a Bible story. It's a literal retelling of the story of Lot. And at some point about half, towards the bottom of the show, with all of this, like, you know, incest and rape and towns blowing up. And
I'm just worried when you said Lot and Bible that everyone's tuning out now.
It's satirical.
Okay.
So, towards the end of the show, we actually have God make an appearance to basically apologize, for everything in the story up to this point.
Okay, great.
So it's character based. Matt, you get it.
Great. So it's God's point of view.
God's point of view. This is God saying sorry. I've been rash, it's true. Ooh. I'm going through a rough patch and taking it out on you. Life as the Lord is lonely, like a gimp without a crutch. I'm not exactly craving strange, but I could use some human touch. This is God saying sorry. I should never have made Eve. While they romped through the garden, I was watching them conceive. Love is such a blessing. Every bump and tug and push, y'all fit perfect together. But where's my burning bush? Sorry for the droughts and plagues, the earthquakes and the flood. Sorry for the wages you paid in sin and blood. It's not that gay sex is wrong, Lord knows you look good in a thong. It's just you were having too much of it. I got jealous and showed you where to shove it. It's so easy to think that I'm above it. Is it really such a sin for God to covet? Damn, girl. This is God saying sorry for all the lives you've lost. While I was up there jerking off, I missed the entire Holocaust. My bad. I love your fornication. Praise me, I see through a
falls. Know that every time it rains, I'm relieving my blue balls. I'm sorry for the smiting and for the crusades. Sorry for the endless wars and also for AIDS. I'm lonelier than you can know. You've seen the depths to which I'll go. I don't blame you if you're wary. I've got all this guilt to carry. I'm so horny that it's scary. Hell, I raped a 13-year-old girl named Mary. Saying sorry regrets the toughest cell. Please, humans, forgive me. But if you don't, I can't promise I won't blow you all to hell.
Just kidding.
Or am I? Barohata, diddy do.
And there you have it. Believe it or not, that is another episode of Improv Nerd in the Can. And of course, we don't go by numbers here. We only go by letters. That was the Mike Dakota episode. And I want to thank Mike Dakota, and I also want to thank Zach Ward, who got us out to Improv Boston to not only teach a workshop, but also do this wonderful episode of Improv Nerd. As always, I want to thank my producer, Ben Caprero, who makes it sound so slick and so professional, and without him, you wouldn't be hearing me speak right now. You can figure this out because you're smart people. We're on Feral Audio, feralaudio.com, but we're not alone there. There are so many great other podcasts over there. Todd Barry's got one, Chelsea Peretti, Dan Harmon, Matt Dwyer, so check out feralaudio.com, and if you like what we do, there's a donate button. You can donate to what we do here at Improv Nerd. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, which will really help you become a better improviser and hopefully a better person, you can go to jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Also, like the Improv Nerd Facebook page because it helps me with my low self-esteem. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Hotel Lincoln and Uncle Fun here in Chicago. And especially you for listening. We couldn't do this without you. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.